Welcome to the IgG4 edition of Rare Disease Advisors Rare Care Podcast, offering unique perspectives from researchers, clinicians, and influencers from the IgG4 community.
Hello, and welcome to the Rare Care Podcast. This is your host, Tori Rodriguez, correspondent for Rare Disease Advisor. Our guest today is Dr. Luke Chen, a hematologist at Dalhousie University in Nova Scotia, Canada, and the University of British Columbia in Vancouver. Thank you for joining us today, Dr. Chen.
It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you for inviting me.
Sure. So tell us about your work with IgG4-related disease.
Well, I was very fortunate to learn about IgG4-related disease about 13 or 14 years ago, really when the disease was starting to become well-known. I had a few cases in Vancouver that were actually quite challenging, more difficult than the usual IgG4-related disease cases. And I was able to correspond with Molly Carruthers, who later moved to Vancouver, as well as Dr. John Stone in Boston, who is the world expert in IgG4-related disease. And they were able to give me very good advice about those early patients that I had. And then when Dr. Carruthers moved to Vancouver, she and I built up quite a large practice in IgG4-related disease. And the two of us were able to conduct quite a bit of research and build up the clinical care programs around that rare disease.
Nice. And so one of the main topics we're going to be discussing today is IgG4-related disease as a malignancy mimic. And you have an interesting story about how that kind of intersects with the discovery of the disease itself.
Yes. IgG4-related disease is really fascinating. Those of us who worked in medicine about 25 years ago may recall that there was an ad campaign for lupus called the disease of a thousand faces, because there's so many ways that lupus can present. I like to call IgG4-related disease the new disease with a thousand faces. It's a disease that really can show up in just about any organ system, from the meninges, the lining of the brain, to the orbits around the eyes, to sinus disease, to the submandibular glands, all the way down through the thorax, the abdomen, the pelvis. Just about any organ you can imagine can be involved in IgG4-related disease. And so it can mimic a lot of different diseases, including cancers. And the way it was first discovered was that one of the most common manifestations of IgG4-related disease is autoimmune pancreatitis. And in the late 90s and early 2000s, the Japanese were noticing that quite a few men in their 50s and 60s were presenting with inflammatory masses in the pancreas, and they couldn't distinguish it very well from pancreatic cancer. So some of these patients were undergoing Whipple's resections, only to find out afterwards that the pathology showed autoimmune pancreatitis rather than cancer. And that can be quite upsetting when, instead of having a major surgery like a Whipple's resection, you could just have steroids. And so they started looking for a non-invasive biomarker to help distinguish IgG4 pancreatitis. Well, at that time, they didn't know it was IgG4, autoimmune pancreatitis, from pancreatic cancer. And they found this little bump in the serum protein electrophoresis. And they found that it was actually elevated serum IgG4. And then they found that there were IgG4 positive plasma cells in the pancreatic tissue. And so they published that in New England Journal of Medicine in 2001, that association between IgG4 and pancreatitis. And then over the next few years, they found that similar IgG4 positive plasma cell enriched lesions were present in many other organs, bowel, lung, lymph nodes, salivary gland. And so they realized this was a systemic disease. And then in 2011, Dr. John Stone convened the world experts from the US, from Europe, and importantly from Japan and Asia at the first international symposium for IgG4-related disease. They gave it a standard name, which is IgG4-related disease. There are many variations, but the actual name is IgG4-related disease, and they standardized the diagnostic criteria.
Fascinating. So since that time, how would you say we're doing with in terms of accuracy and differential diagnosis?
I think we're getting much better. What was really exciting between the discovery of the disease in 2001 with its association with pancreatitis, and then the subsequent discovery that it was a systemic disease in 2003 affecting many organs, is that over the next decade, they discovered the disease actually encompassed many, many different entities. So, for example, there was a disease called Mikulicz disease, which is idiopathic swelling of the lacrimal and salivary glands, which had first in the medical literature been described in a German farmer in the 1800s, and then was known to affect many, especially younger Asian women. And they called it Mikulicz disease, but they didn't know what it was. Well, it turns out that if you do a biopsy from the salivary or lacrimal glands, you find these IgG4 enriched plasma cells, and so it's IgG4 related disease, or Mons disease, which is idiopathic retroperitoneal fibrosis. When you do a biopsy, you see IgG4 positive cells. It's a part of the spectrum of IgG4 related disease. Riedel's thyroiditis, a woody infiltration of the thyroid gland, that's also IgG4 related disease. So a lot of these rare eponymous entities fell under the umbrella of IgG4 related disease. One of the senior Japanese investigators at a meeting I was at, he said, "It was like a black crow against the night sky. The bird was always there, but very difficult to see," which I thought was a very poetic way to put it, right? Here's this
Absolutely.
mysterious, here's this mysterious entity that was always there in the background, but we didn't know what it was. And all of a sudden, we see all these rare diseases that are falling under the umbrella of the disease.
Yeah.
So we're getting better, but the other interesting thing for me is in summer of 2023, I moved from the west coast of Canada to the east coast, from Vancouver to Halifax, and I have it's supposed to be a rare disease. I already have like 25, close to 30 patients in my practice with IgG4 related disease because I'm getting referrals from family doctors, from specialists, from other people who kind of knew what it was, but didn't really know what to do with it. And so they're all being sent to me now, which is fantastic because there are very clear treatment pathways for these patients.
Yeah, and so are you seeing so of some of those patients, have you seen some that were potentially mistaken for malignancies?
Absolutely. So the classic malignancy is pancreatic cancer. And then I would say Klatskin tumor or biliary cancer, because these patients will show up with painless jaundice, which is the classic sort of warning sign for pancreatic or biliary cancer. And they often have a very elevated CA19-9, which is a tumor marker. It's non-specific. It goes up when people are jaundiced for various reasons. But often when you see those things together, the painless jaundice, the abnormal CT scan or MRI, with the thickening of the bile ducts or the pancreatic mass and the elevated CA19-9, the assumption is that this person has a biliary or pancreatic cancer. The other cancers it tends to mimic, the big one is lymphoma, because about 70% of patients have lymphadenopathy, and they can really look a lot like lymphoma, or periorbital tumors. So patients coming with swollen lacrimal glands or periorbital pseudo tumors, so they can be mistaken as a malt lymphoma of the orbits or other head and neck cancers. Those tend to be the big ones.
Okay. What are some of the maybe potentially more rare ones that you've seen in terms of malignancy mimics with IgG4 related disease?
So there's a lot of overlap with IgG4 related disease and other rare diseases, which makes it even more complicated because, most doctors who are experienced with pancreatic cancer, they're very, even if they're not familiar with the IgG4 related disease, they're very familiar with the pancreatic cancer. So, it's easy to say, okay, this is not like, the pancreatic cancer that I'm used to seeing. Where it becomes tricky is when the IgG4 related disease is overlapping with another rare entity. So, for example, it can really mimic EGPA or eosinophilic granulomatosis polyangiitis, also known as Sjögren-Strauss syndrome, which is a vasculitis. It's not that rare to a rheumatologist, but to other physicians, it can be quite tricky to diagnose. But they can both IgG4 related disease and EGPA can present with eosinophilia and polyclonal hypergammaglobulinemia and lymphadenopathy. The big difference is that EGPA, there's often skin involvement, whereas IgG4 related disease, that's rare. And the C-reactive protein is usually quite high with EGPA, whereas it's typically quite low with IgG4 related disease. A couple of other major mimics are Castleman disease, especially the new form of idiopathic multicenter Castleman disease, which is called idiopathic plasmacytic lymphadenopathy, or IPL. That entity has been described in the literature from East Asia, from Japan and China for many decades, but it was really only recently, in the past year or so, fully accepted as a subtype of Castleman disease. For many years, there was some debate about whether it was a subset of IgG4 related disease or whether it was a subset of Castleman disease. I think the debate's settled now. We know it's part of Castleman disease. It presents with a lot of IL-6 upregulation and very high C-reactive protein, very high serum IgG4 levels, and often very enriched IgG or very IgG4 enriched lesions in the lymph nodes. And we now know it's part of the Castleman disease family, but it can really look a lot like IgG4 related disease. The other major disease mimic to be aware of is the histiocyte disorders, especially Rose-Hydorfman Détume disease, which is ultra rare. That's a histiocyte disorder that presents with lymphadenopathy, can present with pancreatitis, autoimmune pancreatitis, and hypertrophic pachymeningitis, and often has elevated serum IgG4 levels and elevated increased IgG4 positive plasma cells in the lymph nodes as well.
So with this like vast range of mimics, of potential mimics for IgG4 related disease, what are some kind of like key recommendations in terms of lab testing for a differential diagnosis or any other, considerations in that vein?
That's a great question. I mean, I think the first thing is just to be aware of IgG4 related disease and its various the many ways in which it can present. And then I guess one key clinical point is that although it can affect almost any organ, it almost never affects the parenchyma of the brain. There have been rare case reports, but it'll affect the lining of the brain, the meninges, but not typically the parenchyma. It very rarely affects bone. There is a subtype called eosinophilic angiocentric fibrosis that affects the facial bones, the maxilla. But otherwise, other than EAF, it doesn't really affect bone. So if you've got someone with a lot of lytic bony lesions or long bone involvement, that is not IgG4. That's probably a histiocyte disorder or a malignancy with metastases or an autoinflammatory disorder. And it usually you do not have extensive skin involvement. They can have asthma and eczema, but it's very rare to have extensive skin involvement. And it, although it's usually diagnosed and managed by rheumatologists, it does not cause synovitis. They don't get arthritis from IgG4 related disease. Keeping in mind, you're allowed to have two things at once. Some people do have lupus and IgG4 related disease, et cetera. But generally speaking, those four organ systems are not involved, or not involved extensively anyway. In terms of lab tests, I would say what's the ones that are often underappreciated, but really, really important are the serum protein electrophoresis and the C-reactive protein. So you should see polyclonal hypergammaglobulinemia on the serum protein electrophoresis. So sometimes I see people just order the IgG4 level or the IgG subclasses. That's just done by nephelometry or by mass spectrometry. It doesn't tell you if it's polyclonal or monoclonal. The SPEP tells you that it's polyclonal because there is such a thing as IgG4 myeloma or IgG4 MGUS. It only makes up 2% of those entities, but you have to do an SPEP, make sure it's polyclonal, not monoclonal. The second thing is the C-reactive protein. More than 90% of patients with IgG4 related disease have a normal or minimally elevated C-reactive protein. If the C-reactive protein is persistently quite high, like more than 20 or 30 milligrams per liter, or in US units, more than 2 or 3 milligrams per deciliter, that makes IgG4 related disease less likely. Of course, you could have someone with IgG4 related disease and active infection or aortitis. But most of the time, the CRP is low. If it's high, then you start thinking about things like Castleman disease or EGPA or lymphoma or other malignancies. So those are the key tests. But there are many tests to order an IgG4 related disease. Always check the organ function, liver enzymes, check the complements, check the urine for protein because renal involvement with proteinuria is fairly common as well. Imaging is important. Do a CT from neck to pelvis, both to look for typical radiology features of IgG4 related disease, as well as to rule out other causes.
Great, thank you. Any closing thoughts on the topic? Any kind of next steps in terms of research in this area, or anything you'd like to see in particular explored in the research?
Yeah, I mean, I think we're starting to get some effective therapies. We've known for years that rituximab is very effective in this disease. Steroids work, but they're quite toxic. B cell depletion is effective, and we just got our first randomized control trial in IgG4 related disease published by Dr. Stone in the New England Journal of Medicine a few months ago, looking at eculizumab, which is a no novel B cell depleter, and it works quite well. So it's an exciting time to be in the treatment area of the disease. In terms of the diagnosis, I would just say that just awareness of the clinical manifestations, smart laboratory testing, and talking with the pathologist is very, very important. Like, if oftentimes I've seen diagnoses missed because the clinicians and the pathologist never communicate with each other. It's very important for the clinician to provide the pathologist with good clinical context, and it's very important for the pathologist to provide detailed reporting using the international consensus criteria published by Dr. Deshpande in 2012. Like, how many IgG4 positive cells do you see per high power field? What's the ratio? Are there other features? So those, the pathologists and clinicians, really need to work together.
Well, thank you again for joining us today. We've been talking with Dr. Luke Chin, a hematologist at Dalhousie University and at the University of British Columbia. And this is Tori Rodriguez. Thank you for listening.
Be sure to follow the latest news, perspectives, and clinical resources on rare diseases at rarediseaseadvisor.com. Thank you for listening.